Here we are in Isaiah chapter 5, and I'd like to read, first of all, simply from verse 4. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? You see, the expectations are great when you're trying to cultivate something. They always are. And then we know about disappointed expectations in our lives on every front. I was once running a children's party, an international children's party, with a colleague of mine when we lived in Middlesex. The hall was crammed with children. And we said to the young boys and girls, that now we're going to have a film, a Tom and Jerry film. A shout of triumph went up. Tom and Jerry. Yes, Tom and Jerry, in colour. Then the hall went dark. The film began, and I realized to my horror that my beloved clerical colleague who had ordered the film, he had done his work all right, but the film agency had sent the wrong film. And instead of a colour Tom and Jerry, we saw a black and white documentary on the British seaweed industry. Of course, the film didn't last too long. Within a minute, I turned it off, said, lights on, yes, everybody, that was very, very interesting. Now we're going to have food, and on we went for the party. It was a disappointment. Here is a situation presented for us, the readers of Isaiah chapter 5, involving the enormous disappointment and sense of letdown experienced by God 27 centuries ago in the face of his apathetic ancient people of Israel and Judah. Isaiah was his outstanding prophet. None was greater. And these opening five chapters serve as a kind of overture to the entire book, which really starts in chapter 6 with his description of Isaiah's initial call. The overture reaches its very strong climax here in chapter 5 with a parable set in the form of a song that really sets the scene and shows what the basic problem was. It's as though the prophet Isaiah is saying to himself, I can't get through to God's rebellious people, not at least by my sermons. Let me try and paint a picture by way of a little love song. And to whom is the love song addressed? Well, I suggest that it's designed for God. Verse 1, let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning his vineyard. Yes, it's God's vineyard, and Isaiah sets out the song so that his listeners can share it, their imaginations caught by the imagery of someone looking after his bit of terrain. They'd all done it. You've done it, with your window boxes, maybe. And they knew what it was to dig and to clear away the stones. I've done it myself, even. We used to live at Blackheath years ago, and we used to clear the stones away from the garden. My dad would pay us sixpence a bucket to do it. Then after a bit we realized we were on the Blackheath pebble bed, 100 feet thick, and the pebbles just went on forever. So then the payment stopped. It was hard, hard work. Back-breaking work. Now here is God portrayed as working hard on his piece of land. God is at work. Then disillusionment sets in at the end of verse 2. And the listeners, why? Well, they knew the experience. You've done it yourself, I've done it. Try to grow things and they just don't work. And so, verse 4, what more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? Or as I think perhaps it should be translated, bad grapes. Bitter, unproductive, useless grapes. Now the expectation was tremendous. Yes, God himself setting very high hopes on what could be. So the first question that this love song puts to Isaiah's listeners, and indeed to us, if we're involved at all in the work that God is doing in his world, is this. What else could the owner have done? The question is put very clearly in verses 3 and 4, where Isaiah puts his audience in the jury bench. Members of the jury, what else could the owner have done? Verses 3 and 4. Now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem, men of Judah, judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. What more was there for me to do, my vineyard? Now it's God speaking. And he's inviting the onlookers to make this judgment. Those who simply treated the love song as a story could make their verdict, and they could shake their heads at one another. No, he couldn't possibly have done anything else. He'd done everything he could have done. He'd selected the right hill, plenty of fertile soil. He'd done the digging, done the planting, built the watchtower, prepared the wine vat. Well, couldn't have done better myself. But those who saw deeper than Isaiah's little story would have begun, I think, to feel twitchy and nervous as the song went on. Because the vineyard, of course, ladies and gentlemen, was a recurring theme in Israel's national life. When Vera Lynn, during World War II, sang about the white cliffs of Dover, she struck a chord deep in the national psyche over here, which assured that the song would be heard by patriotic people from Britain all over the world. Well, it was the same with the vine. Every country has its patriotic songs, and we had ours. Here was the vine theme that featured very strongly in a number of unforgettable hits in Israel's life. So back in David's time, the psalmist had come out with these lyrics: "Thou didst bring a vine out of Egypt. Thou didst drive out the nations and plant it. Thou didst clear the ground for it. It took deep root and filled the land." And then the psalmist adds his prayer: "Turn again, O God of hosts. Look down from heaven and see. Have regard for this vine, the stock which thy right hand planted." Well, you see, that's from Psalm 80. And you can imagine some of Isaiah's listeners thinking, hello, 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 it's the same vine theme coming up again. Well, of course, that's probably us. Hope it's not trouble. But it was trouble. What else could the owner have done to ensure fruitfulness on the part of Israel, whom he'd brought out of Egyptian tyranny, looked after, reared, delivered from adversity over those many centuries? And then centuries later, there was a man who was standing in Jerusalem and told his own story of a vineyard, how he'd put it into the charge of tenants, however, let him down, and turned on his representatives when they visited the place. Then Luke 20, verse 13, the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my beloved son. It may be that they will respect him." But no, said Jesus, it was his parable. They killed the son on arrival. "What then will the owner of the vineyard do?" asked Jesus. Answer, he will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. And Jesus' listeners were horrified at the story's punchline. It's really, you see, the same story all the way through. God placed tremendous expectations on the vineyard that was Israel. He expected fruit from it that would benefit the entire world. Ethical standards, justice, true worship. And when Israel failed, reverted to outworn heathen practices and to idolatry, the question went up, what else could the owner have done? So here in Isaiah 5, verses 5 and 6, they spell out the fate of the vineyard. So its protective hedge, it'll go. So will its surrounding wall be pulled down. The place will be just trampled underfoot. It's inevitable. I was born in East Africa, and when I visited Tanzania some years ago, they showed me the result of the ill-fated groundnut scheme that the British government decided to inaugurate many years ago. They thought it would help if they grew groundnuts. It would somehow help the economy. It didn't work. The locals gave them the right advice. They said that the soil's all wrong for groundnuts. Don't plant. The weather's all wrong. The nuts are wrong. Everything is wrong about the scheme. But still, the British government went ahead and planted groundnuts. The whole thing was a fiasco. And £37 million later, it was realised that it was not going to work. And when I last visited Kongwa, is the place, the groundnut scheme centre, they showed me what had been called Millionaire's Row, where the people in charge had their residences. It was just turned into toilets now. The place trampled, weeds everywhere, riotous. Well, in this case, it was the British government's fault. But in Isaiah, the fault didn't lie with the owner. The land was fertile, verse 1. No, it was just something about the vineyard itself that was at fault. So, at the end of verse 5, Isaiah shows his hand a little bit as to who the vineyard owner is, that he should order the clouds to withhold their rain from it. Such a figure of authority could only be God. And verse 7 gives the whole game away. Why, this is the key verse of the entire chapter. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, says Isaiah, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. And he looked for justice. That was the real fruit that God looked for. But behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, a crime. The Hebrew experts tell us that this is a play on words in Hebrew, that if you were to reproduce it exactly, it might read, did he find right? Nothing but riot. Did he find decency? Only despair. And that surely is the first question that Isaiah asks in this chapter about the failed expectations in the life of God's people. What else could the owner have done? Nothing. But there's a second question. What else could the prophet have said? Look on, if you will, and just scan, would you? Have a look at the Bible. Don't look at me, look at the Bible. Verses 8 to 23. We didn't have time to cover them in our earlier reading, but if you look down the page, you will identify, I think, six woes against the leaders of Judah, representing as they did all of God's people. There's a woe in verse 8, then several verses later in verse 11. Move on a few verses to 18 for the next woe, then not so far on to verse 20, then less further on still to 21, closely followed by verse 22. So like those hatching marks on the road when you're told to slow down on approaching a roundabout, the woes follow each other with increasing rapidity as Isaiah moves his listeners towards their rendezvous with judgment at the end of the chapter. We've looked at what the owner of the vineyard said about the failed expectations in Israel's life. Now look at what the prophet says in these six woes. We can only sketch it out briefly. First, there are the power-mad people. That's how I describe them in verses 8 to 10. Wheeling and dealing in their craze for more land, more property, more influence, more power, at the expense and decline of others. God says to such people in verse 9 that they will end up completely unproductive in the end. The 10 full acres of vineyard would only yield one bath of wine. That was a measure that equaled a petrol tank, roughly, with a medium-sized car, perhaps 8 gallons. The estimate was that a vineyard that size should have produced 500 times that amount. And the proportions are the same in regard to the seed that was sown. All it would produce, a solitary ephah. Well, that was, if you compare it with Ruth chapter 2 and verse 17, no more than Ruth, the Jewish girl, gleaned in a single day after the reapers had already harvested the field. Pathetic. The power mad. They would be unproductive. Secondly, there were the joy riders, verses 11 to 17. People today complain about the young people who grab a car for a joy ride. But, says the prophet, far more irresponsible were the leaders of Judah. Instead of being contributors to society, they were consumers only. There are, it seems, in the end, only two kinds of people on planet Earth. Those who think of themselves as contributors and those who think of themselves as consumers. Which category do I fit into best? Ask yourself that question today. Because, verses 11 and 12, Judah's leaders only really thought of their appetites. Whole generation would suffer, verse 13 onwards. They would suffer from oncoming national disaster, from a lack of the knowledge of God's word and ways. In the end, says Isaiah, the joy riders who only live for their appetites will themselves, to quote verse 14, be gobbled up by the dark gloom that has its mouth wide open to receive them. And as for their property, verse 17, why, the sheep and the goats will graze among the ruins eventually, just as they did centuries later at Congwa, following the groundnut scheme. Nothing to see. The power mad, the joy riders, thirdly, the triflers, verses 18 and 19. People here not so much being dragged into sin, but actually pulling their sins along behind them, eagerly, with their careless, cynical, and irreverent treatment of God. We can't see that God is active in today's world, they say in verse 19. Or if he is, let's see him speed it up a little bit. They don't care. They're triflers. Then there are the debunkers, verse 20. It's a very popular sport today to rewrite history, to tear down honorable reputations built up in an earlier age, to call evil good and good evil. Very fashionable. It was fashionable in Judah of the 8th century as it hurtled towards national catastrophe, the debunkers. Then there were the big heads. There they are in verse 21. The people who are wise in their own eyes and shrewd in their own sight. The people who were their own walking oracle. All of life was one long after-dinner speech. So opinionated and conceited are such people that they will finally talk themselves out of the kingdom and are a bore to Almighty God, who can barely get a word in at all. Lastly, there are the jet set. Great heroes, says Isaiah ironically, but only in their know-how about mixing the drinks, booking the flight, fiddling that deal, verse 23. And if they'd been living today, their symbol, their logo, wouldn't be the scriptures, but a whiskey glass in one hand and a mobile phone in the other. Six woes pronounced upon the power mad, the joy riders, the triflers, the debunkers, the big heads, and the jet set. Are these sins around today? I'm afraid they are certainly in the world at large, but are these sins evident in the lives of God's people, the church? Which, if we take the church as being God's new Israel, is today's counterpart of the vineyard of Isaiah's song, well, I'm afraid they are prevalent. Partly because I know myself. A Christian or a church can become power mad, especially if it is somewhat on the large side. Always a temptation to think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. There are the joyriders in Christian society today. They've not come to give service. They're part of the great consumer society. And the unbelieving world looks at them and says, they're just pew polishers. Where's the holiness? Where's the drive? The triflers are around all right. Yes, they're present in the evangelical world too. Part of the grapevine of worldly, albeit evangelical, gossip, tittle-tattle, where God is somewhere outside on a limb. The debunkers are everywhere. People who find it impossible to give praise and encouragement to fellow believers and to promote good. The big heads, the non-stop talkers who give themselves no chance to grow as people and as Christians. And the jet set, for whom regular prayer and the daily feeding upon the scriptures is to enter upon life from another planet. Two questions then we looked at in our passage. What else could the owner of the vineyard have done but abandon the vineyard and let it go to ruin? What else could the prophet have said but pronounce these woes upon the perennial sins of God's people across the ages and that exist today? I left myself a minute or two for the last question. Here it is. What else could the people expect? We mustn't do more than run our eyes down the page from verses 24 to 30. It's not a very inviting spectacle, I'm afraid. To see a vineyard going up in flames, as described in verse 24. The sin was to reject God's standard and call for purity of life. To reject all of that, we learn from verses 24 and 25. Now, this isn't retribution upon non-believers that's depicted here. It's the inevitable consequence of the insiders, yes, of the church, losing its grip upon the great imperatives of God's law and standard. If you do that, God has always shut down the ages. One result is quite certain. I'll make a fool of you in everybody's eyes. Or as he puts it in the book of Revelation, I'll take your lampstand away so that you'll give out no more light. I'll bring you into disarray, says God, if you as a company of people neglect my ways. Now we take this as a church. We must. As far as the people of Judah were concerned, verses 26 to the end put it clearly enough. A far off nation would be summoned by God, whistled for as a dog owner might whistle, and God's people would come under the army of the approaching Assyrians. Yes, it's the Assyrians that Isaiah is speaking of, the biggest war machine that the world had ever seen. After them would come the Babylonians, and the rest of the chapter describes the advance of this instrument of judgment that was as terrifying and as inevitable, to quote verse 30, as the roaring of the sea or the arrival of a hurricane. God's vineyard, that's us, were part of it. We are to all souls a part of it in New Testament understanding. Think of the words of Jesus. I am the vine, the real prototype vine. You are the branches. You're part of me. Abide in me, and I in you. And if you stay close to me, and let my words stay in you, John chapter 15, then you will bear much fruit. Much fruit. What is the fruit? In the end, it's ethical standards. It's becoming more like Jesus Christ. And if you and I are fulfilling that goal of becoming more like him, regardless what the other circumstances are, we shall be fulfilling the goal for which we were born. And we shall be fulfilling the goal for which the church was set in operation. The expectation of God is very great, and we take to heart the questions that this passage has posed. What else could the owner have done? What else could the prophet have said that those words? What else could the people expect but to land in disarray, losing their way completely? I end with a quote from an American pastor, Eugene Peterson, speaking of those expected to give Christian leadership and a high standard to others. He says, I don't know of any other profession in which it is quite as easy to fake it as in ours. Let's have a moment of quiet. Deliver us, O Lord, from the world of make-believe, which it is very easy to fall into. Deliver us as a church from being just a fake church. Deliver us as Christians, if we are Christians, from simply going through the motions. And help those who are on the edge of Christian discipleship to take your summons seriously, gladly, and joyfully, and to embark with you in the kingdom, which is the greatest of all enterprises. We ask this for your holy name's sake. Amen.